Hello, and welcome to Baltic Ways, a podcast bringing you interviews and insights from the world of Baltic studies. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis, and today we are speaking with Dr. Volodymyr Duovik, a professor of international relations at Odessa I. Mechnikov National University and an expert in U.S.-Ukraine relations, Black Sea regional security, and Ukrainian foreign policy. And, on a personal note, my former professor during his Fulbright at the University of Washington. Today, he speaks with me about the view from Ukraine, how his work has shifted during the war, and takeaways for Ukraine from the Baltic states. Stay tuned. Dr. Duovik, maybe we can just start with you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm an associate professor of international relations in Odessa, at Odessa Ilya Mechnikov National University. I'm dealing primarily with international relations and subjects like U.S. foreign policy, U.S.-Ukraine relations, Ukraine's foreign policy, a little bit of theory of international relations I teach as well. And I'm also interested in the Black Sea security studies. So that's what I do normally. I mean, there's nothing normal these days, of course, about what I do or any of us here in Ukraine. Currently, I am an internally displaced person in Western Ukraine. Well, together with millions of other Ukrainians have moved to Western Ukraine away from battlegrounds of the ongoing war that Russia is waging on Ukraine. My hometown of Odessa is not occupied, fortunately. But it could be. So therefore, to avoid this eventuality, I had to move out of Odessa. And that's where I am right now. That's where I'm teaching my courses from, online lectures for my students who are nominally from Odessa, but who are also spread all over the place. Some in different parts of Ukraine, some abroad, some are in Odessa, stay in Odessa. And doing a lot of roundtables, a lot of panels on this war that Russia is waging on Ukraine, and doing several projects in the process. So basically, more or less a routine kind of work, except for it's happening with this background of this war, and I'm not home now for more than 3 months, and that's how it is now.
Yeah, it is, to put it mildly, a very difficult time. You know, you're a professor of international relations and looking specifically already at this region as your area of focus. And I wonder how has your work shifted, or what are some of the takeaways that you have seen from your perspective, both as a Ukrainian who is living through, this situation and of war and being internally displaced, and as well as from your research perspective?
Right. Well, I mean, the priorities have shifted, obviously. I mean, every trouble and every problem that we saw prior to this war seems so small now. I mean, we are all in the business of survival, basically. I mean, the countries and people who used to live, because, of course, the scale of uprooting of Ukrainians from the places where they used to live is massive here. It's about 1/3 of population that we're talking about, I mean, including refugees and internally displaced persons. And a lot of people are just managing to survive and fit in. And if they have enough, money and resources to move on, some don't. Some people don't have universities to return to. Like, for instance, my colleagues in Mariupol and Kharkiv, their university is badly damaged, and not to mention that Mariupol is occupied. Kharkiv is not, but quite a few buildings of university are basically not in the shape where you can actually return students and professors to them. In Odessa, luckily enough, university is not damaged. It's still there, so we can formally go back, and I hope to do that once we might be sure that Russian occupation is not a threat anymore. And in my professional life, everything I do is now rotating around this war. Most of the conversations I'm having this last several months is on the war, different aspects of the war. So any other subject is just secondary or something like that. We are talking about different aspects of the war. We are still trying to understand what preceded it. And what led to it? Like, was it inevitable or not? Why is Moscow attacking right now, of all times? You know, what pushed it to do this massive invasion? And frankly, most of us were mistaken before February 24th. A lot of people did not expect invasion to happen. A lot of people also were thinking along the lines, like I was, that this probably will be some kind of military operation, but not something that massive and that brutal and that long too. I thought personally that there might be an attack, but I didn't know where, but I thought it would be like more or less a surgery, a minor operation by Russian military troops. And then it ended up for like a big operation, big war. So we're still thinking like, why is that happening? And then also, of course, trying to make sense of what happened in the last several months and how we can improve Ukraine's chances not to lose, and what's the right way to deal with this, how to communicate with international audiences as well to explain them better what's going on, because there's so much misunderstanding, less of it in, say, Europe and North America, but much more around other parts of the world. So a lot of times I have to interviews with various journalists from around the globe, and I'm trying to explain what's going on because some people are not very much in the know, or they don't know the details, and don't know the context and stuff like that. And in this month, I had interviews with people from Chile to Singapore, you know, and Australia, and everyone in between. So I mean, that's not nothing has nothing to do with my research as such, but I'm serving as someone, as an ambassador of Ukraine, basically, quotation marks, explaining what's happening and what Ukraine is trying to achieve, and what we worry about and what we hope for. And there is also a big discussion about the primary directions of our relationship this month, last month, one of them being relations with US. And actually, that's my topic. That seems to be the most narrow, most close to me topic of my research, US-Ukraine relations. And it's very much critical now for us. I happened to receive a grant to continue research on US-Ukraine relations during the war from the Kennan Institute, from Wilson International Center of Scholars in Washington, D.C. And I talk about it often. Actually, tonight, I'm going to have a lecture on US-Ukraine relations since February 24th for Ukrainian audience in Ukrainian. And this will be a concluding talk for my little course that I'm doing with Fulbright Alumni Association here on US-Ukraine relations, where I analyze everything since 2014, actually, since the start of Russian war on Ukraine. And the last topic today, the last 10th presentation, is exactly on what is happening since February 24th. So in addition to my usual audience in that course, I'm adding some other Ukrainians who are interested to know more about my perspective on this. So a lot of other things on the mind, not just US-Ukraine, obviously. We are talking a lot about Ukraine-NATO relations, like what's the best way to proceed. At some point, it seemed that Ukraine was ready, our leadership was ready to give up formally on NATO membership to satisfy Russia, and maybe bring closer the cessation, the end of violence and the conflict and the war. But then, again, this is not clear now what Ukraine should do in terms of its security for the future. Should we keep this NATO membership for the more distant future for us? Should we think about security guarantees along the lines what Zelensky and his inner circle are probably thinking these days? What countries might give us some viable, effective security guarantees for the future? Or should we just, I don't know, rely on our own resources, and basically turn our country into some kind of a military camp and be prepared for further acts of aggression from Russia? That's a topic which is hotly debated. Another one close to me, I mean, nominally, because I'm in Odessa. I'm not there now, but my soul is and my thoughts are. So we're talking about Black Sea security. And these days, this is a hard topic as well, because it has something to do with incoming famine in a number of places around the world. And the reason being Russian blockade of Ukraine's Black Sea ports, including Odessa. So that's a big topic. What can we expect in the Black Sea security throughout the rest of this war and beyond that war? Like, when the war is over, what's going to happen there with the Black Sea security, where Ukraine is going to be a player? And if Ukraine is fortunate enough and strong enough not to lose this conflict, or maybe, I'm afraid to say this, win this war, then Ukraine might become actually a de facto leader in the region and what that would mean for the region. And that's one of the important subjects that we discuss these days. So basically this, everything is rotating around the war and like what is happening, what can happen, what can the West do or should do to help Ukraine better. How is Ukraine probably not doing enough in terms of its PR or foreign policy, reaching out to foreign partners, this kind of things. Because right now, of course, everyone's nerves are on edge. And therefore, sometimes maybe Ukrainian leadership or foreign ministry are doing some mistakes, something. But that should be understood because they are living in the wartime situation and they're functioning under the wartime situation. And that's why we need to discuss this too, like what's the best way to deal with our partners. So that's about it.
Yeah, it's quite a shift in mandate, right? To go from being able to work in kind of intense academic sphere, but now being not only the academic expert, but also the ambassador and the explainer for everybody. You mentioned kind of speaking to people who might not have a very strong understanding of Ukraine. And I wonder what those outside of Ukraine are missing.
Yeah. Well, they sometimes don't know the roots of the conflict. They kind of know that there was something there before between Ukraine and Russia. So this is not completely new. This is not coming out of nothing, this war. But they lack information about what it was that led to this conflict. Other things that they also often, tend to buy Russian narrative, something like what happened since 2014 was a civil war, basically Kyiv government waging war on Donbas region and something like that. So you have to explain this is not true, explain about the Russian aggression, explain about Crimea and what happened early on in Donbas and what the role of Russia was. That's often missing. But also with this war, they also tend to focus on military operations, but then you have to explain there is so much damage done to civilian sector. Many more civilians died than military, actually. So you're trying to explain what Russia is trying to achieve there. They are at the loss about the possible aims of Russian aggression. And that's difficult to comment on because no one really knows what are the aims. And one of the ways to explain what Putin is doing is that he is making himself those aims on the goal. Meaning that he probably shifting some of those objectives, along the lines of operation. So you don't know. You just speculate and you give options, and you sometimes cannot give a definite answer. And not all journalists appreciate that because often they are looking for some kind of definite answer, and sometimes very difficult to give one. Or also, the shifting situation with the peace negotiations, like what is Ukraine prepared to give to Russia? Or not, and when, and do you know when the war will end? I don't know. No one knows. I mean, it's really decided on the battleground. For now, we see it's not about to end anytime soon, but will it become months more longer or years more longer or something like that? I mean, I don't think the scale of the fighting is actually feasible on both sides for much longer. Because, it's one thing, this low-intensity conflict that was there between 2014 and 2022, but it's much different from what we're having now. Both sides are already exhausted, Ukraine and Russia, in many ways. So, and then, therefore, probably there would not be that much of this hostility on this current scale for much longer, but it's hard to predict. And that's why sometimes journalists are looking for some kind of, like I said, definite answers. And they're not finding it. There's also much that they miss in terms of a cultural background of this all, like why Ukraine is so important, like why Russia might be willing to destroy Ukraine's identity and culture. Why is that so important? Is Ukraine really that close to Russia or not? If it is that close, like why is Russia waging the war on Ukraine? So it's sometimes really complicated to explain these little details that we kind of live through, but they, of course, don't know much about it. If you're talking to someone from far away, they have many other issues to monitor, to observe, to discuss, to write about. And Ukraine-Russian relations is not one of those. So you basically have an army of people who have very little education in these issues now writing about this war. And therefore, you need to give them an express course, the crash course on what is Ukraine-Russia relations, what it was prior to February 24th, and how it shows itself in this current war. So that's about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like the whole world has gone through a little bit of a crash course and still much to learn. Thinking about one area that of the world that does tend to have a little bit of better background on the situation in Ukraine and because of their own experience, I'm thinking of the Baltic states, and you too have also participated in a panel with the AABS, the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies. And I wonder what there might be for Baltic Studies scholars to do to support Ukraine and Ukrainian scholars and Ukrainians.
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, several things I would like to say if I don't forget all of them. Let's start with saying that we here in Ukraine, we should have done a better job in terms of learning their lessons of three Baltic countries there in dealing with Russia. We missed a lot of time in terms of moving closer towards the EU and NATO. For instance, if we have decided early on to move decisively in that direction, we would probably be there already, members of both of those alliances or union. But maybe not, but closer than now. Another thing is how you deal with Russia in terms of counter propaganda. Well, we're learning now, but we didn't do much prior to 2014. Also, in terms of cybersecurity, again, if you just look at the experience of Estonia alone, that's a huge amount of information how to deal with cybersecurity. And finally, in terms of dealing with energy dependence on Russia, again, it's a masterclass that they can give any of those three countries to us in terms of how to diminish the dependence and how to deal with this issue. Now, these days, of course, I should say we appreciate very much so the support is coming from these countries. I mean, everyone here in this country of Ukraine now knows for a fact that these three countries are the most devoted and true friends of Ukraine, and they feel our pain, and they do more than they can, actually, in terms of helping Ukraine, be it sending weapons or hosting refugees or sending humanitarian assistance and stuff like that. So we all see it and we really appreciate it. We understand that we're talking about three countries which are not huge. Therefore, the resources are limited. You know, they're not great powers, superpowers, but to us, they are, you know, superpowers because they are assisting in such a decisive way. So therefore, I should say that we really appreciate the assistance. Or other things as well that we can talk more about new formats of cooperation, security cooperation, that is. But there are many, many theories out there, like, for instance, the Baltic Black Sea Cooperation Zone. We've been talking about this for years. Actually, we've just concluded last year a big project with the University of Tartu and many others in the region, from Sweden, from Poland, and from Lithuania, and four universities, including mine in Odessa, the big project, EU-funded project on the Baltic Black Sea Security Cooperation Zone. Another thing, of course, is Three Seas Initiative. And finally, there is now, even along the war, in the time of this war, ongoing already, there is a new initiative of some kind of a new security structure consisting of United Kingdom, Poland, three Baltic republics, and Ukraine. So we also very much supportive of this idea of Finland and Sweden joining NATO. I mean, some people, of course, in Ukraine have some bitter feelings as well, because like we've been trying to get to NATO, we were not given this chance. But I would argue, like I said already, that it's mostly our fault that we didn't get there. But right now, of course, people are saying, oh, okay, we are under attack. We wanted to be within NATO. We're not let in. And look at it, Finland and Sweden just announced they want to be part of it, and immediately the next day the NATO is ready to accept them. So is it fair? But I would say it's fair because this country is much more meeting the criteria, and also there is a different situation now that they are becoming members of the organization, which is capable of producing more security for the Baltic region. So that would really mean that Russia would be completely isolated in the Baltic region. That's a great thing. I mean, I think for the countries of that region, there'll be more of a, if not security, then at least of a deterrent containment potential for these countries vis-a-vis Russia. I hope that we would have something like this here in the Black Sea region, but probably not, because there's much more diversity here. Well, Russia is part of it, of the region as well. Obviously, the aggressor country, but also you have a whole bunch of other countries which are now trying to figure out what to do in the context of this war ongoing. Like Turkey is basically talking both ways. And the position of Turkey is very important. Romania is definitely very much pro-Ukrainian right now and supportive. Bulgaria is fledgling, but actually turning towards more of a pro-Ukrainian and anti-Russia grouping. Just look at the recent decision of them together with two other countries, North Macedonia and whereas Montenegro, not to allow airplane by Minister Lavrov, foreign minister of Russia, to use their airspace. So basically preventing his visit to Belgrade, to Serbia. So that's quite showing, that's quite telling. So Bulgaria is probably turning a corner here towards more of a decisive and robust position of being critical of Russia, what Russia is doing to Ukraine and generally in the region. So in many other smaller countries like Moldova and Georgia and others, where, you know, Armenia, Azerbaijan, we also consider them part of the Black Sea region. They're all making their own lessons, all right? They're learning their own lessons in terms of this Russian invasion against Ukraine. But can we actually use more of that experience from the Baltic region? I hope so. We should be looking harder in terms of what they have achieved there and what preceded this and why they were able to achieve more of security there in the region, and how can we actually copy some, at least some of this experience here in the Black Sea region. And the scholars of the region, they understand the problems that we are facing right now, and their expertise is very much needed. And we have been listening a lot to people who would normally be talking about the Baltic security issues, but now they're talking about the Ukraine-Russian war, and therefore their experience is needed as well. So I think that just reaching out to Ukrainian scholars and helping them through these difficult times, you know, that's also something. If you live in a country which is stable and developed and you can, you know, spare some of your attention and funds, frankly, with Ukrainians, some of whom are abroad now, some are here in the Western Ukraine, like I am, for instance. And, you know, I'm not complaining. I'm doing fine myself, but many of my colleagues are basically renting apartments and houses for some astronomical figures, and they have to pay, and also if they have family, they have to feed the family. So basically just coming up with some effort to collect money to support Ukrainian scholars, that's also very much appreciated. But then you need to find out a right way to deliver that money, like how do you deliver this money to particular people or some associations here in Ukraine. That's also not very easy to figure out, but it's happening. I'm seeing it. It's happening. Reaching out to Ukrainian scholars like myself here. And there's more and more non-resident fellowships for Ukrainians also from various Western institutions. And I think the Baltic region universities and think tanks can also do more to provide those non-resident fellowships for Ukrainian scholars who couldn't, for various reasons, come to the region and continue their studies there. And one of the reasons with people like myself, of course, is that we are men, and men between 18 and 60 are not allowed to leave. So I'm often getting these nice offers to come and to do some research here and there. But I cannot do that because of martial law still in place here. And right now it will be in place till the end of August, at least. And that means people like myself are not capable of leaving Ukraine, but we are capable of continuing our professional activities. And that's why I'm saying that the focus should be on non-resident fellowships for people like myself. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, that is a very practical mechanism, potentially. I am so thankful for that opportunity to speak with you. And, you know, just on a personal note, I'll say that I think often of the class that I was in with the classes, I think several, so which were just very formative for me. So I want to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
And for taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Good to see you.
Bye. Thank you for tuning in to Baltic Ways, a podcast from the Association for the Advancement of Baltic Studies, produced in partnership with the Baltic Initiative at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. I'm your host, Dr. Indra Ekmanis. For more content on the Baltic states, tune in to the Baltic Power Hour from FPRI's The Continent, a podcast hosted by Aaron Schwartzbaum. And as always, subscribe to our newsletters at aabs-balticstudies.org and fpri.org/baltic-initiative. And a quick note that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of AABS or FPRI. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.